Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
Patrick, you know how we have a listener of the week who we feature in our newsletter every week?
Sure, Jim. It's one of my favorite parts of our free newsletter.
Me too. And you know how we sometimes ask the listener of the week to give us their philosophy of life?
Yeah, I do.
Well, since you can't be listener of the week, would you share your philosophy of life?
Absolutely. Mine is, a house is not a motel. What's yours, Jim?
Maybe the people would be the Times or between Clark and Hilldale. Okay, Patrick, so yesterday we had Nick Scalera on the podcast, and
yes,
he wanted to talk about this album that he really, really loves, and we got to talking, and he really wanted to give us good context for this album and what went into the recording and the origins of the band and all that kind of stuff, and we got to talking, and he got so into it and so enthusiastic and so just like inspired by this that we decided let's make this a twofer. Let's make this two episode deal.
Totally.
And so we didn't even get to the album yet. We were so busy talking about the band and its origins and what made it so great that now we're actually going to get to the album at hand. So it's Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster. And what album would that be, Jim?
Well, let's ask our friend here, Nick Scalera. Nick, what album are we going to talk about today?
Well, thank you guys. And we're going to talk about Forever Changes, the masterpiece album by the band Love. And we talked yesterday about the first two albums, which I'm kind of glad we spent some time talking about them because I think those are also worth your time listening to. But Forever Changes is the masterpiece, and we'll dig into that today.
Agreed. And sometimes you need that, you know, you got to understand what led up to this great piece of work. Can I just say that I'm so dumb that I just today realized that it's meant to be read as like one title with like the artist and the title together. It's supposed to be Love Forever Changes, right? I just,
that's correct.
I always think of it as just Forever Changes, right? Because the band's name is Love. It was only when I did a Google search and I was typing it in and did Love Forever Changes was like, oh, that makes sense. And then I read that that's the case. That's how it's supposed to be read, right?
Arthur Lee has definitely said that that was his intention with it. And in fact, the album title came from a young woman that he was dating at the time. And she said something like, Arthur, I thought you said you'd love me forever. And Arthur said, well, forever changes. You know, then the love part is like a love affair, forever changes. Anyway, however it got there, we have it now. We'll get into it.
Totally.
So let's get into this album.
All right. So Forever Changes, it's released in November 1967. That's when it gets out. But they start recording it during what everyone knows as the summer of love, right? Mm-hmm. You know anything about rock and roll lore, you know, it's the burgeoning of hippie culture, all that great music coming out, it's a gorgeous weather, free love, blah, blah, blah. You're not going to get that on Forever Changes. You're not going to get the sort of hippie, dippy, everything is great veneer. Arthur is going to open your eyes to the reality of a lot of things going on, the hypocrisy of the era. And I think it's another one of the reasons why this kind of lives on, right? This album just doesn't feel embedded in the summer of love. You know, when I hear Surrealistic Pillow, for example, that's just so embedded in that psychedelic era.
Totally dated. Yeah.
This one is not. This one is a different story. So to bring us up to where we get to the recording of this album, it's also, we talked a little bit about the castle, or at great length about the castle. Lee had actually left the castle by this point, and he moved to a house on Mulholland Drive. And in fact, this house was also famous because it was featured in a film called The Trip. So this is The Trip House. So we went from the castle to The Trip House. What is kind of most significant about this was that it had a view of the valley. Forsey, the bassist, said that he and Arthur would look down over the city, Arthur staring and wondering about the ambulances and the sirens. And that's where his vision of Forever Changes starts to take shape.
And Nick, I'll say right there, too, I love that you mentioned The Trip, because in this time period, people remember, they would basically, some places would give guys money to like, hey, take acid for a weekend and just film a guy stumbling around with some loose plot. And like, that's a movie, right?
So, yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
Artistic privileges, yes, there are a lot of them, but who used them to follow their vision and who used them to like do a cheap exploitation, you know, movie? So.
Right, right. It was for normal folks to look at the hippies and see them on screen.
Exactly. That was part of it too. You got to sell it to the Midwest and, you know.
It's freak show. So here's Arthur up on the hillside. There's a great quote from Arthur about what he was thinking before this album started. This is from the Einarsson book. And Arthur said, at the time I wrote those songs, I thought this might be the last album I'd ever make. The words on Forever Changes represented the last words I would say about this planet. The album was made after I thought there was no hope left in the world. I thought I was going to die. I used to sit there in my house on the hillside and think of all the things that had happened or were happening all around in my life, as well as to others. I would write them down the way I saw them. So this is deep stuff,
wow,
man.
And that's heavy, dude. That's me on November 3rd.
Yes, or maybe we'll be happy. Who knows? It could happen. Who knows? So this is sort of gives you an idea of where Arthur's mind was before they get into the studio to do Forever Changes. And as we talked about before, you know, you get this sort of dark underbelly of the Summer of Love. It explores racism. Right. There's a lot of stuff about the Vietnam War. You know, I was just thinking about this. I'm like, we all love Sgt. Pepper's. There ain't no mention of the Vietnam War in Sgt. Pepper's, you know, came out in the Summer of Love. There's not mention of it in Surrealistic Pillow, but Arthur was telling it like it is. You know, there's a lot of stuff about alienation and hypocrisy and mortality is a big, big thing. So I thought what we'd do to start this is actually to start off with the first song, which is Alone Again Or. And this song is really been described by Jack Holzman as the portal. It's kind of, if you don't have this song to open the door to what you're getting Forever Changes, I think it all kinds of falls apart. And it's just a fabulous song. It's the one song, if you've never heard of Love, that you might have heard before. It was covered by The Damned in the 80s, which is a fabulous cover as well. I highly recommend it. It's also of note that this one was actually written by Brian McLean. So this is one of the two songs from Brian McLean. It's an opener. It's not especially deep lyrically, but just the vibe of the song and the mood it sets, I think is really sort of gives you some pointers of where this whole thing is going.
Somebody said to me, you know that I could be in love with almost everyone. I think that people are the greatest ones. And I will be alone again tonight, but dear.
It's great. That is an absolute classic song. And I think it's become more well-known over time, right?
Definitely. You know, they tried to release it as a single. It's not like it went anywhere in the chart in the late 1967. But I mean, that's sort of that mariachi trumpet when it comes in. It's kind of spine tingling. And you know, the guitar style is a flamenco style. And that's something that we talked about, Arthur Lee being sort of the main person, but Brian brought a lot to the table. And one of the things that Brian McLean brought is some of these other musical influences like flamenco style guitar and sort of these like flourishes, the mariachi kind of thing. And so there's just a lot going on musically there, and it sets the tone for the rest of the album.
It is. And you're right. There's so much going on there. It blends a lot of different styles. But then at the end of it, it's just like so memorable, like just the melody and sort of the drive of the song. It just sticks with you too. I think a lot of people really love that song. And I also going to mention too, yesterday I mentioned the Ramones cover. Today I'm going to mention that Matthew Sweet and Susanna Hoffs covered this song on one of their Under the Covers albums. So
right. And even a lot of Love stuff has been covered because they influenced a lot of other artists. You know, not to bring this back to Flying Nun, I guess I'm obligated to under contract.
Yeah, that's right.
But a lot of those Flying Nun bands, like, listen to Love. It's very obvious in stuff you hear in the Verlaines that he was influenced by Love. So a lot of artists listen to these guys.
Totally. And a lot of those guys were influenced by that West Coast psychedelia of the time. But I will also say this, when you listen to this record, there is that sense of when things are first starting to come together, right? For the first time. Like, there's that first wave of creativity that kind of snowballs and makes everything magical, you know, that first combination of all these different cultures and people on the same wavelength. And this really is kind of the first and maybe only, right, Nick, perfection of Arthur Lee's vision.
I think that's definitely the case. And I think that, you know, ironically enough, Alone Again Or, even though it's written by Brian McLean, it's about being alone and being lonely and being kind of alienated, which is basically what Arthur's going to talk about throughout the rest of the album. So it
sets the scene. They were all on the same wavelength at that point.
They were. I think they were on the same wavelength musically in terms of how they got along. Not so much.
Right.
And in fact, this sort of leads me to another thing that's sort of a legend of this recording session, is that they got into the studio first day. You know, Arthur had been writing these songs up in the Trip House. He brought them to the band. It was obviously a very different direction. And they tried to lay down the backing tracks. And basically, Arthur turned to the producer, Bruce Botnick, and is like, these guys just can't hack it. They can't play what I need them to play. They're like stoned. They're not into it. Whatever it was, he was just like, these guys are not cutting it. And so Botnick was like, well, why don't we get a couple of session musicians? And who do you think those session musicians were, right? Do the math. We're talking about the Wrecking Crew, right? So they literally went out the next day. They brought in Hal Blaine. They brought in Carol Kay. And they brought the session musicians in and they sat the rest of the band in the control booth. And they said, now these guys are going to play the tracks for these songs. And there's a lot of back and forth between the band members and other witnesses as to what actually happened. The Wrecking Crew definitely played on the song we're going to hear next, which is The Daily Planet. Played on another song. I believe it was Amore Again. There's debate over whether the Wrecking Crew stuff ended up on the album or whether the band stuff ended up on the album, because whatever happened, the band did get it together. And whether this sort of incident of bringing the Wrecking Crew in is sort of like a disciplinary measure, it did work because the guys got it together. Michael Stewart plays fantastic drums on the rest of the album. Ken Forsey's fantastic on bass, but maybe they were scared straight a little bit by this experience. But there's still some doubt as to who. I am pretty certain, I've listened to a lot of Wrecking Crew stuff, that the Wrecking Crew is the backing band for the Daily Planet just because of the drumming. It just sounds so much like a Hal Blaine. It's so snappy. But Michael Stewart, many years later, I was like, you know, I overdubbed the drums and Carol Kay couldn't handle the bass. And I'm like, come on, that can't be possible, right? But anyway,
no one ever said that.
It's a little controversy, but it's an interesting tidbit. And it just, again, is sort of indicative of those times that, like, if you're in LA laying down an album and you just needed to get some dudes to, you could grab the Wrecking Crew to discipline the band. That's just crazy to me that that happened.
There was like a price out there on the website. You just click pay and
right. Let's take a listen to Daily Planet. I think it's a fabulous song. Whoever did the backing tracks, they did a great job.
You know, the other thing I think that's kind of interesting too about this time period, Nick, and I'd love to hear your thoughts, and Jim, no one really knew where music was going, right? At this point, like, put yourself back there. Like, everything was pointing in different directions, like world music, you know, like what's going to be the next thing and like what do you really love? And that kind of reflected somewhat in Forever Changes too. Right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot going on, and it's interesting to bring up. So the one thing that I think folks listening to Forever Changes are either going to love or hate is the orchestration on this, right?
Yeah,
so totally. Obviously there was a lot of orchestral stuff happening in rock music in this era.
Totally.
The difference with Forever Changes is, and this is why I will argue for Forever Changes, to even folks who hate like classical stuff in rock, the orchestration is not an afterthought. It wasn't just slapped down at the end. Arthur Lee had this vision of how these songs would sound orchestrated, right? And Jack Holzman had said, well, you know, let's go a little more acoustic. What do you think about that? And Arthur's like, okay. And, you know, he started having this vision for orchestrating these songs. And Jack brought in this guy, David Angel, to be an arranger, a classically trained musician, obviously. And, you know, the way he describes working with Arthur was that Arthur would sit him down and be like, here's the song playing, you know, you play on piano, a little bit on guitar. And he would literally hum the orchestral bits, like vocal. He'd sing them to David Angel, and Angel would just kind of write it down. And Angel is so insistent that he actually didn't get an arranger credit on the album. He's sort of like with help from David Angel, like arranged by Arthur Lee with help for something. I could look it up on the record. Y'all could see it. But to this day, I saw an interview with him that came out in 2006, David Angel. And he's like, I was there to help get the stuff written on notes so that classical musicians can play it. But it was all Arthur. And those songs, the orchestration where horns and strings would come in was all thought about when they were recording their regular like band, right? So it wasn't like the band did their thing and then they slapped down. It was like the vision of where the orchestration would happen was intrinsic to the recording of this. And yeah, that's why I think it really holds up that way.
I was about to say that, Nick. I think that's why it holds up. It was one man's artistic vision, and he tried to realize it with the tools at hand. So sometimes we have those things, right, in art. But man, when you hit it like this, it's a sweet moment. It really is.
I think you really... You hear that because what you will hear in some of the songs that we're playing is that you will hear like a guitar playing a lick that the horn is also playing. You know what I mean? Themes are totally very integrated. And also, again, just the lyrical themes, the song we just heard, The Daily Planet, like there's this whole run in there about this person that he calls Plastic Nancy. She's real fancy with her children. They'll go far. She buys them toys to keep in practice waiting on the war, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like Arthur sees the kids playing around and it's like they're just getting ready to get drafted because they're playing war, right? So that's sort of the undercurrent of that song. And it's kind of a deep hook into there. So love Daily Planet, fantastic song. And again, the orchestration, that's why it holds up over the years. It's just integrated. It adds texture and contrast, and it's not an afterthought. You know, Library of Congress said it's arguably the most distinctive, sustained orchestration in rock music. So
that's a pretty good argument. And I'll say this too, Nick, and be interested to hear what you think. And Jim, you know, when an artist realizes his vision, part of it has to be that they interpret the times they're living in, right? And they make sense of it for other people, right? Because that's part of the problem right now. Like, who can I trust that makes sense of this whole crazy situation? Right. Like, there's got to be a writer or filmmaker or somebody who's interpreting my vision. And, you know, that's part of, I think, why Dylan and Arthur Lee and all these people from the 60s hold up, because they figured out a certain part and a scene. And that's so important. And, you know, man, I'd love Arthur Lee. And this is a fascinating
topic. I don't think anyone could have seen the 60s in the way that Arthur Lee did. I mean, I think his perspective was just so different than your average middle-class white kid in a folk rock band.
Yeah, completely. And he saw through all the barriers, right? Yeah. He brought in all these different people. Yeah, you're totally right.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, too. There's a story in the Einarsson book where Arthur Lee is talking about when they did the orchestral recordings, right? They brought the orchestra in. And Arthur, he says, I walked into the studio and took a seat in one of the chairs. I must have been there at least 45 minutes when one of the classical musicians said, if this guy Arthur Lee doesn't show up soon, I'm leaving. I said, I'm Arthur. Most of them, if not all of them, couldn't believe their eyes. This black hippie guy is Arthur Lee. They looked at me as if to say, you wrote the music on the charts we're supposed to play. I said to myself, yep, I sure did. That's Arthur for it. Amazing. The sort of barriers totally that he was climbing. Well, great. Let's hear another song, The Red Telephone, and we'll chat a little bit about that one.
Sitting on the hillside, watching all the people die. I'll feel much better on the other side of the road. I believe in magic. Why? Because it is so quick. I don't need power when I'm hypnotized. Look in my eyes. What are you seeing?
I see.
How do you feel?
I feel real phony when my name.
You get right there at the beginning, sitting on a hillside, watching all the people die, right? That's how the song opens. We talked about the hillside.
Yeah.
And, you know, Arthur is just kind of, he's standing outside of these times a little bit. He's observing them and he's living them and sort of detached from them at the same time. Right. You know, and there's this whole sort of riff in the middle where he talks about, if you think I'm happy, paint me white, yellow, black. And there's this whole riff where they're like words come together. And it's a sort of like fact that we're all, you know, human beings, but we're all having these different tribes and whatnot. Again, who else is going to bring that perspective other than Arthur Lee? And this is just a fabulous song.
It's amazing. And like, what is the one thing about love that you like the most or attracts you to this band the most?
I mean, I love obviously the orchestration and the music, but the lyrics just, they've been in my head for so many years.
Yeah, they're so distinctive.
The way that Arthur could sort of turn a phrase. So I think of this every year around April when I'm doing my taxes, this line, "Sometimes I deal with numbers. And if you want to count me out." Like, that just plays in my head. And there's other scenarios where Arthur Lee lyrics just are sort of embedded in there because I think they're just so clever and they're so relatable to a lot of different things that go on day to day.
Absolutely. And I'll say this too. I think that, Jim, we had an episode from Tim Hoffman that was amazing about lyrics that weren't song titles, but were embedded in the album titles. But think about the titles that Arthur Lee made, man. That was one of the things about Forever Changes. When I got this record, I was like, wow, like, these are the song titles. They're so weird and crazy. Like, yeah. I love this. And they all sort of weirdly matched up with the music, man. You know?
Absolutely. And here they are putting out this like amazing piece of art. And in the meantime, the world's going on, right? So
right.
In June 16th to 18th, there was this thing happening up the coast called the Monterey Pop Festival. You might have heard of it. Well, you won't be surprised to hear that Love was invited to play. And Arthur said, no, I'm not going up there.
Right.
And so they're essentially laying down Forever Changes, right? They've got the song. They had been in that film with these songs, I mean, that film was huge, and that film sort of hit like a year later. You know, think about what it did for Hendrix and The Who, and that was a huge sort of missed opportunity. Of course, they couldn't have known at the time, but that is sort of the alternate history that I think of. I picture in my mind like Love on the stage after like Janis Joplin, but you know, before
Jimmy.
Well, that's
one of the most transcendent moments in music history, like if you read about it, folks, right? Because Captain Beefheart had an acid hallucination right on stage in Monterey and said, like, I can't play, right? He saw someone in the audience turn into a fish or whatever.
Right.
And like Love didn't play. And like, there were so many moments that could have happened. There was definitely a karmic convergence at that moment.
And it's interesting. This happens now in 1969, Arthur, and this is post the current lineup, the best lineup. He was invited to play Woodstock also. And he also turned that down. So he might be the only band to turn down both Monterey and Woodstock.
Amazing.
So
it's a long way to go
for you.
Yeah.
So again, just sort of keying in on that timelessness of this album. It's as beautiful and meaningful today, I think. And there's this great quote again that I pulled from, I believe, the Einarsson book that just sort of sums it up. And it's like, the album's timelessness is rooted in the fact that it eschews almost all the trappings of its era. There are no backward tapes, no Indian flavored ragas, no sitars. There are no meandering fuzz tone guitar excursions, no trippy poetry. Indeed, the album's lyrical themes offer a stark audit of the underbelly of 1967, not its hazy veneer. Love had created music that defies labels and typecasting. Perhaps it is why it went over the heads of its peers and has instead connected with later generations. So I think that really sums it up, why this just sort of doesn't feel of its time. It's outside its time. And believe me, I love the psychedelic stuff from the 60s. You guys know that. It's not like I'm trying to diss Peppers or Revolver or Pet Sounds or whatever, but there's a lot of lyrics on Sgt. Pepper's that'll bother the hell out of you if you actually think about them. So, you know, Patrick had referenced the song titles. Here's the most interesting song title that Arthur ever wrote. I think we should listen to this song. It's called "Maybe the People Would Be the Times" or "Between Clark and Hildale."
This is my favorite.
Moms are common seen around my town. Everyone is painted brown. And if with you that's not the way, let's go paint everybody gray. Yeah.
Hey, the good humor man sees everything.
He sees everything like this.
When I first read that, I was like, maybe he is a spy. Like, it was incredible.
Yeah, and you know, the reference Clark and Hildale, that's the Sunset Strip, right? Not that I know. I've never been there. But you know, I've read that like up Sunset
Only
Boulevard.
Hunter makes his kids take a picture when they go to the Sunset Strip.
There you go. Right. You know, and this song is sort of like catches the vibe of sort of being out amongst the young folks who are on the strip. You know, remember that was where that song For What It's Worth was about, like the kids riding on the Sunset Strip. That's those kids, right? And this song definitely has that sort of vibe of just like hanging out, being with your people. But there's all kinds of other stuff going on. You know, there's a riff in here about everyone in his town is painted brown. And if we feel that's not the way, let's go paint everybody gray. So again, it's just sort of like he lived in the spaces between, you know, he wasn't like one thing or another. And that, I think that's just, that was his sensibility. So fantastic song. If you've heard that one and you don't like it, all right, maybe Forever Changes is not going to click with you. And believe me, I've had this discussion with many other music fans, some of whom you know from Rock in the Suburbs, part of our community. Some folks are like, look, I've listened to it. It just doesn't hit for me. I'm like, that's fine. Right. It's an acquired taste and it's either going to sink in or not. And if it doesn't, no worries. But if it does, it's like a lifelong kind of joy for me just to kind of have this as a soundtrack to things that's going on.
But honestly, I think that's what makes it great. And I totally get that too. I think it's one of those albums that it clicks or it doesn't. And I would say the same thing about other albums that are considered great albums. I would say the same thing about Pet Sounds. I think there's a lot of people who listen to Pet Sounds and are like, eh, I don't know. What am I listening to? You know, I don't mean that like putting them down as listeners. I just think they don't necessarily get it. I have this weird block with Joni Mitchell's Blue. Like I've tried and tried and tried to listen to that album. It's always like in the top 10 of like greatest albums ever.
Yeah.
And it doesn't work for me. I don't know what it is. So I think
that's a great reference.
I think that only just proves why this is so great, because it's one of those records. It's like, you sort of like love it, or I wouldn't say hate it, but you just, you know, you're indifferent to it, right?
Right, or it doesn't work for you.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, totally.
I feel bad because I feel like there's some people who, at my behest, have tried it a couple of times. Like, no, do it again. My long-suffering wife has listened to Forever Changes a gazillion times, and I wouldn't say she's a big fan, but
got kind of a Clockwork Orange situation going on in your house, right?
So, yeah. Well, it didn't work the first 500 times, so it's not going to work this time.
Yeah, that's right. Just one more. You haven't heard the mono mix yet, have you?
You don't remember us having this conversation?
Exactly.
Well, I'll say this, too. I think there's a lot here, I think, Nick, that's important in the sense of indie rock. Right, rock in the 80s and the stuff that, you know, becomes our foundations, right? Platinum, you know, Replacements, whatever. But we have to understand that, like, there are these tentpole albums that kind of come up, and you're not sure why you like them. And sometimes you like them because the artist you love like them, and sometimes you know, you like them for a reason you can't define, you know. And sometimes there's just something weird that speaks to you about this album, and I think all three of those boxes get checked for me with Love. I can't really explain that much why I like it, but I just like it, and I'm glad I have it, and glad it exists. And if I, you know, start feeling bad, I'll play it. It'll make me feel a lot better.
Yeah, so, it does that. Yeah. Yep, for sure.
It's definitely part of that sort of indie rock canon,
totally,
right?
Man, it's right down the spine.
I mean, it's sort of like, you know, when I started college, I thought I was pretty hip because I was listening to like Echo and the Bunnymen and, you know, whatever. And I met some guys who were sort of at the radio station. It's like, all right, I need you to listen to Pet Sounds. I need you to listen to Forever Changes, the Velvet Underground's first album, you know, and the Stooges, you know. It's sort of like this list of like seven or eight, and that this is always one that's in there. And this is going to ground you for sort of indie music. And I think what grounds you is not particularly the orchestration or the music, but it's the independent spirit, right? It's like, we don't need to be stuck in the trends of the time. We're following a vision. We're going there.
There's a feeling in this album that you can't quite describe. And I think that's what you're getting at, Patrick. Like, you know, almost like, I don't know why I like this so much, but I just really do. Yeah. And it's kind of transcendent in that way. Well and said. I also like, I want to say too, Nick, that you've talked about too, the kind of timeless aspect of this. I always kind of like too, that this album almost seemed kind of floating off on its own somewhere. Like I said, it didn't really fit into any scene. You know, it was hard to draw the line, you know, of like 60s music through this album. It was kind of up there over some other place, you know?
Right. Totally.
Exactly. And the album comes out in November of 1967, right? So they're recording it in the Summer of Love. It doesn't come out till November, right? So it's already like a totally different vibe because it's winter, like the Christmas season. The album doesn't chart. It got to 154.
And when was Monterey? It was July.
Monterey was June, right? So
June, right? Yeah. And they were that hot that they could have played and made the album sell even more. So that's
they could have. It would have been a great way to sort of propel it. But, you know, it comes out in November. It got to 154. The lead single didn't even make Alone Again, or as we talked about, didn't make the top 100. Not really surprised. One thing I will point out, I'll do a shout out to our friend Stephen Routledge in the UK, is that the UK audience appreciated it much more. because they have more sophisticated taste than us Americans. It reached number 24 in 1968 in the UK, which is huge when you think about what was in the charts in the UK in 1968. Right. But here it was like, you know, it came out before Christmas. As brilliant as it was overlooked. You know, nobody got it. It was frustrating and demoralizing. You know, Arthur was like, gets to our postscript of what happened to Arthur afterwards. Like, when you put this out there and it just drops like a thud, like, how do you recover from that as an artist? How do you move on? And in fact, years later, I mean, Arthur disowned this thing for many years. I mean, he came back around and we'll chat about that. But for a long time, he kind of trashed it. Like, I don't want to play those songs. I'm tired of that blank, he would say, you know, I'm not playing that blank anymore. It's a family show, folks. And that was sort of, that was his attitude. You know, he'd poured his heart and soul into this and it just went nowhere. And, you know, maybe touring would have helped it. But I also think Arthur kind of had a point. Like, I made this beautiful thing and no one got it. Like, what else can I do? Like, you know, touring might have helped, but it sort of fell on deaf ears. Yeah. And I think it had a lot to do with Arthur's kind of decline in years later was this, you know, Brian Wilson went through a similar thing, right? With Smile. I will say one other thing. I think there was another episode, right? I forget which one of the community did it, but there was an episode about album closers, right?
Yeah.
So I didn't say it at the time anywhere on social, but You Set the Scene, which is the closing song on Forever Changes, is a just phenomenal album closer. It sort of picks up where Alone Again or the opener left off. And it actually ends on kind of a hopeful note.
Yeah.
It's a long song. It's actually three songs that were stitched together. So again, you even have like, they were doing the Beatles kind of thing, right? Putting three songs together.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of themes of like, look, you've got one life to live and time is short and live your best life. And this is the time in life that I'm living and I'll face each day with a smile for the time that I've been given such a little while. I mean, I think about that a lot when I'm having a bad day, right?
Totally.
You know, Arthur had rough times and I'll chat a little bit about that to close out, but he gave us this and, you know, we're all forever indebted to him and the rest of the band for giving us Forever Changes. And You Set the Scene is just a fabulous way to close it out.
This is the time in life that I'm living and I'll face each day with a smile. For the time that I've been given such a little while, and the things that I must do consist of more than style. There'll be time for you to start all over. This is the time, and this is the time, and it is time, 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 time,
time. Yeah, so I don't know. The way that ends is just, I mean, honestly, it makes me tear up sometimes. I'm not afraid to admit that. I'm old enough now. Like, it's a very emotional song and there's just a lot going on, you know, and there's a vignette in the middle where it's like, there's a man who can't decide if he should fight for what his father thinks is right. There are people wearing frowns who screw you up, but they'd rather screw you down. Like, who hasn't thought of that, right? But it does, again, it does end on this sort of like, for every happy hello, there'll be a goodbye. There's like just mortality and trying to sort of get through life and make something worthwhile. And when you kind of listen to the song again and think about Arthur's life and sort of what happened later, it's really powerful.
I'll say too, like, after all this time, when you hear Love, you know, within the first 5 minutes, 5 seconds, you know who it is, right? And there's a lot to say for that.
Yeah.
I mean, there are not that many bands that sound that distinctive.
Absolutely. And, you know, just as a sort of postscript to this, the original band basically breaks up after Forever Changes. They do one more single, which I think would be cool to play out with together.
Well, give us the top level Wikipedia view of that.
Yeah, I mean, the band was coming apart at the seams anyway. The Brian McLean rivalry with Arthur was just kind of at fever pitch. And they just got fed up with each other. And Arthur was like, I'm done with this. I want to go in a different direction. And he did. He got another three guys together. And the next album, For Sale, is a lot more sort of traditional R&B, hard rock kind of stuff. And then through the 70s, he had several different lineups. And it was sort of became like, you know, that quote from the guy in The Fall who's like, if it's me and your
granny on bongos, it's The Fall. It's The Fall. Yeah.
That's what Love was through the 70s. It was Arthur Lee and whoever he sort of picked together. I mean, he tried a couple of different albums and just, you know, his life went sort of down the tubes. He wasn't having any success musically. He got into some trouble with the law in the mid-1990s. He served 5.5 years in the penitentiary for discharging a firearm, which was a complete bogus charge. He ran afoul of the three strikes, you're out, because he had had a prior conviction for drugs. So they slapped this really harsh sentence on him. A guy who was there at the time said, a white man claimed, I shot the gun, not Arthur, and that wasn't good enough in court. Eventually, he did get out after 5 years on an appeal because he got bad defense. But, you know, it was a rough time. Before then, he had a lot of different relationships, didn't have a lot of, you know, money problems, drug issues, spends these years in prison, you know, but the good, sort of the happy ending is that he gets out after 5 years and his career has a real resurgence. He meets up with these guys, this band actually called Baby Lemonade, who were, interestingly enough, I think getting back to stuff we're talking about earlier, they were sort of like indie rock guys that loved Forever Changes. And they hooked up with Arthur Lee and they started playing the album in its entirety. They toured it in Europe. There was different lineups, but one of the things that he started to do was to play Forever Changes, which he said he'd never play again, from start to finish with full orchestra.
It's so interesting, man, about that. But, you know, some of the people that have played these masterpiece records, you know, Big Star's Third, and like, you know, how do you take a record on tour? Ah, fascinating.
Yeah, and I mean, people were crying in the audience when he sort of made his comeback, and I would have been crying out loud. And I kind of kicked myself because I wonder if I could have saw him. I don't know what I was doing in 2004 or 5 that I didn't get to one of these shows. There were a bunch of them. He toured a lot.
And this is not on the same scale. You know, I saw a comeback tour of Jeff Mangum from Nutrimilk Hotel, and people were crying at that.
I think I was at that same show.
Thing.
Yeah, at the DAR.
Yes, I was there.
People were,
my tears dripped on you.
People were openly weeping and singing the songs, and it was
it was that same thing. Like, finally, I've been able to witness this dream. So
So, you know, great that he had this second chance at fame and to get the recognition he deserved. He gets this Library of Congress thing. In fact, the UK Parliament actually voted a resolution saying that Forever Changes was the best album ever created.
Right,
that Love was the best band ever. And there, I guess, there was a couple of MPs that pushed this resolution through and they handed it to Arthur.
We elect people.
You know, can you imagine that happening in our Congress? You know, could you imagine?
Right. Yeah.
So
it's McConnell's favorite album.
So he did, you know, he got that sort of victory lap, a little bit of appreciation for everything that he had done, which I think is really gratifying. Unfortunately, you know, he didn't live long enough to continue along that because he was diagnosed with leukemia in 2006. And, you know, he had stem cell treatments and various things, but, you know, he didn't make it. He was only 61. And, you know, tragically, pretty much all the guys in Love died early. Brian McLean died in the 90s. Ken Forsey died in the 90s. None of them had great careers or life.
Yeah.
You know, Johnny Eccles is still hanging around making music. He's on Twitter. He's been interviewed. He's, you know, I would recommend anyone, if you're interested, he's got several interviews on YouTube. Really fascinating guy. Huge part of the sound, his guitar sound. He used to play like double neck guitars that was kind of rare at the time.
Yeah,
so he's kind of the only sort of original link who's still out there in the world. But again, glad we had it. Glad it's still here for us. It lives on. I hope we got some more people to try to listen to it. You know, give it two or three tries, folks.
Check it out.
Doesn't work,
sure.
Then let it go. Move on.
All right. I have two quick questions for you. One is specifically for Nick. I think you alluded to this, but did you discover this album when you were in college?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. I didn't know it existed. Literally didn't know it existed until I was like 20. Someone handed the album to me. I was like, you got to listen to this.
Okay.
And I was into music. Yeah. And I'd listened to a lot of stuff, but I'd never heard of them.
Yeah, no, you're not alone in that. I think a lot of people discovered it sort of, you know, later on, or just sort of offhandedly somebody, you know, suggesting they listen to it. It's one of those music nerd kind of albums, right? So if you know somebody who knows of it, they pass it on to you, right?
I mean, my aunt and uncles were hippies, and they handed me down all the Beatles and Doors albums. They'd never heard of Love.
Right, right.
Yeah.
As I said, it was off somewhere else. It was not. It was like a satellite, you know, just circling the Earth, waiting for someone to tap into it. All right. Well, thanks very much, Nick. Thanks for this. This has been a really great couple of episodes.
Thank you, guys. I'm thrilled to do it. I've been wanting to do this for a while. I had to get it out of my system. So
good.
Now,
we are glad.
I can move on. I hope we did it. It's due, and that we turn some people on to it, or those who are longtime fans. Like, look, I'd listen to 10 more podcasts about Love if they're out there. So add this one
great.
To your...
For sure,
so
man.
We're happy to be of service to you, Nick, that you can get this out and provide that platform for you. But also, if my scheduling is correct, I think these two episodes are going to drop right around the time of great national importance in this country. And I'm happy about that, because I think this is what we need right now in this country is love. We need more love, right?
Exactly.
Be more love, and I'll meet you guys in New Zealand.
All right. If anyone would like to comment on Forever Changes or the band Love or anything else we talked about, we'd love for you to call and leave a message and we'll get your voice on an upcoming episode. The number is 612-440-1984. There you go. Or you can email us, rock@suburbspod.com, or you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, all of those at suburbspod. If you would like to find out more about how you can be a patron of the show, like Nick Scalera, you can go to patreon.com/suburbspod. All right, let's get out of here. You mentioned the playout song is
Your Mind and We Belong Together, which was the last single that the original lineup did. It was after Forever Changes. Gives you an indication of where they might have gone if things stayed together. Very underrated song. Most people haven't heard it.
Excellent. All right. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Linehan.
I'm Patrick Foster.
And with us has been
Nick Scalera.
All right. We'll talk to you all later.
I'd like to understand today. Then maybe I would know who I was when I was when it was yesterday. The seasons and the reasons are on display. And I know
me and your granny on bongos. It's the fall.
It's a family show, folks.